Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koç is my name, and I'm joined this week by my co-hosts Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim. Gents, wonderful to see you both again.
Likewise.
Well, let's start with Syria, shall we? For the first time in more than 50 years, the country is not ruled by a member of the al-Assad family. The president since the year 2000, Bashar al-Assad, has been toppled. His government has been overthrown. He himself has fled the country and, by all reports, is now in Russia. And things are looking very, very interesting indeed. It is a fast-moving story. Things are changing by the hour. But let's take a step back for a moment. Ozan, take us through what has happened over the last fortnight in Syria.
A lot, put simply. Look, I think we need to go back probably a little bit just so that we can give everyone some context and probably remind those who may have forgotten how we got here. The Arab Spring in 2011 pretty much resulted in a number of the countries within the broader region, the Levant and North African region, resulted in a number of uprisings. This was always also the case in Syria. And unlike some of the other countries around in the region, the al-Assad regime had a very heavy and violent crackdown against the uprising and what was at the time pretty peaceful protests. And also, obviously, that resulted in what we saw for the next 13 years, a very violent civil war. By all accounts, 500,000 people dead, over 10 million displaced, many of whom ended up in Europe and in Turkey, and a regime that I think throughout the civil war got even more brutal. Obviously, it was a civil war that had Russia and Iran being very heavily involved. I don't think we probably have time on this podcast to go through all of the different parties. They evolved and morphed into one another all throughout the last 13 years. But as we have seen probably in the last 12 months to 18 months with Hezbollah and Iran losing a lot of their power and weakening, particularly by not being able to support the Assad regime on the ground, we saw a consolidation of a lot of those opposition groups, particularly one that is referred to as the HTS, which is the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, who effectively took a bit of a leadership role. This is a terrorist organization. It's a jihadist organization, but it has tried to soften its stance, soften its the edges of the organization, and really spent the last year or two reaching out to various different parties and putting together a coalition. And as you mentioned, about 2 weeks ago, they saw the opportunity, a good opportunity to go on the offensive. And within 2 weeks, they pretty much took Aleppo, Homs, and all the way to Damascus. It was very well coordinated with the other kind of factions of the Free Syria Army. And I think they had very little resistance from the armed forces, Assad's armed forces. And we saw Assad leaving Damascus the other day, and his regime being toppled. It's happened very fast. I think it took a lot of people by surprise. I don't think people were expecting such a quick takeover, such little resistance. But I think it goes to show that many of those sponsors, Russia, Iran, really have been somewhat weakened in their ability to support the Assad regime.
So, Rodney, what does happen in Syria now? I mean, there's effectively no government from what we understand. There's calls for free and fair elections. What's your view on sort of the next chapter for the troubled country?
I think the greatest risk for Syria now is that, you know, the opposition win the war and then lose the peace. And the next phase, it's hugely important that, you know, that Syria doesn't find itself in the same position as some of the other dictators who were toppled after the Arab Spring, or Western intervention, you know, Iraq post Saddam, challenges, to say the least. Similarly, Libya post Gaddafi. So that management of the transition is key. It is interesting that the outgoing prime minister has clearly been in contact with the opposition, and there's some form of order trying to be imparted within the transition, and hopefully this will be not something which descends into another round of civil war. But with large external influences withdrawing, perhaps the influence of Turkey will be able to help manage the transition in a way that the externals that are withdrawing aren't going to really be involved. So Turkey for me is probably a key player in this.
I think what's worth also mentioning in this context is, you know, I mentioned that the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, is recognized as a terrorist organization. Now, if they had their way as spearheading this coalition going into power, they would certainly be going towards a very Sharia type of regime. They are a Sunni organization. So for those who may not be aware, Al-Assad family are from the Alawites, which is a splinter kind of cult or grouping from Shia Muslim, so different to Sunni Muslim. If they had their way, if the circumstances were different, if this wasn't on the back of a 13-year civil war, I suspect that the HTS organization would be trying to impose much of its Sharia kind of caliphate-style thinking. However, I think the people of Syria, the Kurds, the Christians, the massive diaspora now who's looking at coming back into Syria, I just don't think we'll tolerate that. So that's why I think the HTS has a very difficult position. If they want to be leading this coalition, they've got to rule pragmatically. They've got to put together something that is as kind of pluralistic, is as kind of accommodating, tolerant of many of the different interests that they need to bring to the table. And it's possible, but I don't think it's possible without significant assistance and leadership from the rest of the global community. And it seems like President-elect Trump has made it clear that this is not America's problem and, you know, America shouldn't be involved. So I don't think they're going to get much leadership from the US, but I suspect others, the regional powers, the regional powers and Europe have to play a role to make sure that Syria doesn't go in the way that, as Rodney mentioned, some other countries have gone when, you know, long-standing dictators have been toppled.
But the first step on this is awareness. And if you look at the carefully crafted media interviews of the leadership of HTS, it suggests that certainly they're aware of the need to present as a more inclusive, progressive, democratic alternative to what Syria has experienced over a long period of time. So that the noise is correct and positive and encouraging. It's whether they're forced through their own membership and to backslide in some way into what they were 13 years ago. Obviously, they are prescribed as a terrorist organization, but I expect that to be unpicked very quickly to allow international governments who want to encourage stability to engage with them directly.
I think you're absolutely right, Rodney, and I think it really comes down to, at the end of the day, all of these people came together in the last 2-3 weeks for one last offensive, because for the last 13 years, they've been sharing one thing in common. They've had a common goal. At times, it's been very hard to get people aligned on that common goal and, you know, acting towards that common goal. But their common goal has been to get rid of the Assad regime. The challenge will be from here to figure out what the common goal is going forward and what the common goal will be, and the common purpose will be. And that will be very difficult, I think, because you've got so many difficult interests that need to be balanced. You have Turkey, whose primary reason for pushing a lot of this and supporting the various, particularly the HTS organization, is to create a buffer between Kurdish-controlled areas of Syria so that it can control its issues that it has with the PKK, which is a Kurdish organization. So it's got a lot of different things that they need to put into kind of the mix. As I said, it's going to come down to leadership, cool heads, and, you know, it needs to have serious kind of leadership from the international community.
What do you think of the fact that it was Russia who granted asylum? And I know that that was somewhat predictable, but in terms of, there didn't seem to be many alternatives. Usually, UAE stepped forward in situations like this, as with Bangladesh earlier this year, or with other leaders who feel they now need to live outside their jurisdiction. And with UAE being sort of instrumental in the return of Assad to the Arab League and so on, when Syria was starting to be rehabilitated in recent years, it's interesting that Russia seems to have been the chosen place to be exiled to, as well as potentially the only option available.
I don't think Assad has many friends left. So certainly the normalization between Assad and many of those Gulf countries and other countries within the Middle East has been taking place. But I suspect if you were Assad, you probably wouldn't feel too safe in the UAE. Not as safe as you would in Moscow, I would think, considering so many of the different, again, interests that are at play in the UAE and what have you. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's a no-brainer. That one or Iran. Probably warmer in Tehran these days than Moscow.
Well, what a career path from West London eye doctor to the unlikely inheritor of a brutal dictatorship, because he was the younger brother, so he wasn't the one who was supposed to take over. His
he passed away in a car accident. Yeah.
And from there to then exile in Russia at a time when Russia's more isolated than anywhere else in the world. It does in some way feel like he's not being rewarded for his many missteps and the regime that he created and supported over a prolonged period of time, punishing his own people. So,
is he going to be welcome in Moscow, I wonder? Because I've got to think that he's put Putin in a very difficult position. I would have thought that Putin would have expected more from him to resist the offensive from the opposition. You never know, mate. He might end up falling off a balcony like many of the many people do in Moscow.
It's quite possible. His wife and I were at university at the same time, same university, but we took different directions after that, and I didn't marry a dictator.
Much to your disappointment.
How life could have been very different for you, my friend. Where does this leave Israel? We've seen Israel carrying out some airstrikes in Syria and, you know, to quote from the Israeli government, to basically make sure that the arms don't fall into the hands of extremists and terrorists. Are they a winner out of this situation?
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, we're agreed on that, Uzan.
I mean, if you're Israel, you're sitting in a very good position, because you've effectively dismantled Hezbollah. You have an opportunity to develop more clear kind of security processes, etc., with a new regime, one that you might have a little bit more sway over, you know. And at the end of the day, I think it's you've got Iran looking very, very weak at this point in time. Because I think the reality is, for Israel, there are those very clear kind of wins. But, you know, Iran and particularly Iran, but also Russia as well, if you're sitting in Tehran or Moscow, you've got to be worried about what this means for your domestic stability. Because the way that these countries typically maintain domestic stability is by, you know, projecting strength, you know, rallying around the flag, projecting strength, fighting the West, fighting the evil West, etc. And if you look like you've kind of taken a backward kind of step in that fight, then it's going to give a lot of people internally and domestically quite a lot of opportunity, people who are already opposed to your regime, to fight within that and, you know, make the most of a weak moment. So Israel obviously benefits from that angle as well. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. And I think that the win for Israel is having dealt with Hezbollah, Hezbollah then not being able to come to the rescue of the Assad regime and the inability of Iran to do anything either. I think it's the damage to Iran, which is a win for Israel. The one thing for Israel in terms of Syria is that the Assad regime made noises about Israel but did nothing about it. So there is going to be a new security border point of friction that they're going to have to manage, and there is disputed land there. But providing that isn't the first point of focus and doesn't become a point of focus for the incoming Syrian government, I mean, Israel's much, much better off. The potential risk is whether the incoming Syrian regime or government feels that they have to revisit that sensitive land dispute that Syria has had with Israel. But I suspect it'll be so low a priority that it won't become an issue for some time, if it does at all.
Well, no shortage of international news, of course, coming over to closer to the Asia Pacific. And well, one country that tried to impose martial law wasn't that successful, and that is South Korea. Ozan, what on earth happened?
That's a great question. Like many other people sitting on Tuesday evening our time in Asia, wondering what the hell is going on in South Korea, it came completely out of the blue. It effectively happened at, I think, about 10 o'clock local time. And the president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, effectively did a unannounced press conference and declared martial law, which obviously in normal times is something that you would declare in most countries, but also specifically in the case of South Korea, in when there is a state of emergency or a war or something like that. He gave as a rationale that that there were forces within South Korea linked to North Korea that were effectively preventing South Korea from being able to govern itself in a secure way, and a bunch of reasons that I think made very little sense to most people. And within 6 hours, this was overturned, and his martial law slash attempted coup was pretty much reversed by the parliament. Out of, I think, 300 legislators, 190 were able to go into the parliament and vote to reverse the martial law, which in South Korea's constitution is effectively the parliament has the right to do that. Now, he failed at that, but he did achieve something that hasn't been achieved in South Korea for a very long time, and that is to get a vote, a unanimous vote in parliament. And so he did achieve that. 190 people made it into the parliament, and every single one of them voted against the martial law, including his own ruling party. So completely bizarre situation. I'm not an expert in declaring martial law and trying to stage coups, but you've got to think that if you're going to stage a coup and you know that the parliament can reverse it, you would at least be able to get the support of your own ruling party. And he couldn't. So he's in deep trouble. And I think he's he kind of was able to escape an impeachment hearing. The ruling party saved him from an impeachment hearing. However, they've just this afternoon approved a special counsel to look into to his role in declaring this martial law, and you know, they have a prosecutors are putting together the case to try and trial him, so to try him in the high court.
Well, that's one government effectively trying to blow itself up, but another one trying to form is that in Romania. Rodney, take us through what's happening there.
Yeah, look, Romania is going through similar problems. Hit a number of Central Eastern European countries, right through to Georgia in recent weeks, where we've had elections. The elections have had more than a whiff of external influence, predominantly from Russia, usually through social media. And like Moldova, like Georgia, and now Romania, there's intervention in this case on the part of the Constitutional Court to try and remedy the situation. And that's what's being played out at the minute. And it's again showing the new risks that are involved around social media, digital media, the ability to create news platforms online which don't have necessarily any proper editorial management where people are receiving information and struggling potentially at times to filter out what is credible and what is less credible. And this is one of those situations where I believe TikTok was said to be responsible as the key platform for the misinformation in later stages of the electoral campaign.
It's really not a very good week for Russia, is it? With the disappointment of Assad, and now with this Romanian issue, one has to ask the question: Are they losing a lot of their kind of ability to influence these things?
Yeah, I mean, look, this stuff has to be played out. You know, the election rerun and so on still has to happen. It has to have a different outcome. And there's still time for significant civil unrest agitated by the right or the pro-Russian elements within Romania to cause a level of instability. I think once they're through this cycle, once it's been the corrections taken place, if that's the right term, in terms of the rerun without this external influence, perhaps we're in a position where we can reflect and say it's a bad time for Russia. I still think whilst there's uncertainty and whilst there's instability within, you know, the European sphere of influence that's been agitated by Russia, then I think they're probably still in a potential success phase. But yeah, I think they would have preferred the election to go ahead in the runoff that there was going to be, having got the outcome that they got in the first round.
Well, not a good week for Russia, according to you, Hozan, but it has been a good week for a certain member of the Biden family, and that is indeed Hunter Biden. His father, President Joe Biden, has pardoned him of the crimes that he has been found guilty for after months, if not years, of saying that he would do no such thing. So both President Biden and his press secretary have repeatedly said to the press that President Biden would not interfere in the judicial process, he would not step in as president to save his son, and then, of course, a massive backflip happens just days before he hands over the reins of the White House to President-elect Donald Trump. Ozan, take us through what happens now. The president has pardoned his son Hunter. Well, actually, before what happens now, was this the right move on behalf of the president to do this backflip?
For me, the system of being able to pardon whoever you want as the president of the United States, I think that system is terrible. I think it sucks. It's open to abuse. And in this case, it has been abused. It was abused by Donald Trump, where he pardoned Jared Kushner, his son-in-law's father. Not only did he pardon him, he's now appointed him to be the ambassador to France. So this system where you can pretty much pardon your family, your close relatives, friends, etc., is an awful system, and something that I suppose you need to put that out there before you can really put your views. I think this is terrible for Biden. It's really, really tragic that his lasting legacy is going to be one of effectively costing the Democrats the election, or contributing as much as he could to costing the Democrats the election, and then now going out with this pardon, which on the surface of it looks very bad, and, you know, pretty much, feeds into the narrative and confirms what everybody thinks about politicians in general, and that they are all corrupt and liars, etc. It's not a good move. I don't buy this whole, if you were a father, you'd do that as well, etc. I mean, not many people are in this situation where they can pardon their children. To me, that's just a very academic argument or trivial argument. I think he would have had much more credibility if he had actually put a decent kind of communication out on this, a decent press release. But again, he just focused on, as a father, I have to do this, and, you know, trying to appeal to the kind of emotional side, which, to be honest with you, I think is most people don't care. At the end of the day, what he could have said was, I think that, you know, our Donald Trump's picks and the way that he wants to take the justice system, the FBI, etc., represents a major threat to many people. He has a list of people that he wants to seek revenge on, etc. And, you know, and he could have pardoned a whole bunch of, and this is something, a commentary that's been going back and forth, but he could have pardoned a bunch of other people, which I think he's actually considering now, pardoning a number of people that Donald Trump has said should be in jail, like Adam Schiff and Liz Cheney. So I think his reasons were terrible. He lied about it. Terrible. At the same time, we also have to ask the question, you know, who cares about these norms? It seems that we live in a world where nobody cares about norms. Nobody gives a crap, if you ask me, that he's done this. And at the end of the day, the only people that care about it are those who want to preserve the norms. Certainly the other side doesn't care, but what it's given is ammunition to the other side. The Republicans, now that Trump can effectively do what he wants and point to Joe Biden saying that he's done worse. So I think I feel sorry for Joe Biden in the sense that he could have finished on a high, but he's really done everything he can to leave a pretty bad legacy, if you ask me.
I also think there's an element of this where Biden's just in a bit of a, you know, I don't really care. Like, you guys effectively forced me to exit the race to the White House for this year. You replaced me with a candidate who clearly wasn't ready to run the level of presidential campaign that they actually needed to win. To your point, Ozan, no one really cares about it. You know, we're going to have 4 years of Trump and full Republican power in the Congress. You know what? I'm going to do this for my family. And this is just what I'm going to do in the sort of final acts of being a president, and family sort of comes first. Like, I agree with you that it's unacceptable, but I think the system is unacceptable and that needs to change, because every president almost has pardoned people, and it sort of goes back to the very early days of you know, the formation of the US, and it actually comes from British rule, where the monarch used to be able to sort of pardon people. You know, I get Biden. I don't know, Rodney, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, for me, I know that there's a long history of this stuff in America, and they all are at it. I still find this pretty appalling, to be honest. There's no real proper rationale behind it. I know that you said that, you know, Joe Biden can't finish on a high, but Hunter probably can. Now, given the breadth of the pardon that he's been given, it's also not someone that you can say, oh, he was young and foolish. Hunter Biden's older than me by a good few years. It's not like this is some young, impulsive person that's being pardoned. I just honestly just don't get it. And I don't get, and I also don't buy that it was some form of malicious prosecution. This is a Hunter Biden's an adult who's surfed off the reputation of his father for his entire career, lived a life that has taken him into significant criminality in terms of addiction and other things, and has now just walked away from it at the end with a get out of jail free card issued by his father. It's really bad. And whilst America might just say, fine, they're all at it and all our presidents do it and they all get a few, at least they're not doing a few thousand, you know, they do a few dozen each or something. I think the reputation of America externally as some sort of place with integrity, standards and values is just, yeah, it's just not there. I don't see this as something I could have done if I was Joe Biden in the same situation. I just would have felt it was wrong. The fact he doesn't feel it's wrong says everything you probably want to know about Joe Biden. And it's probably a good thing he's no longer president of the US, even if someone with some questionable ethics is coming in to replace him.
I like how you had to be measured there. But again, it comes down to a part of it also, I feel sorry for Joe Biden, because, I mean, the amount of shit that he's copping for this is you know, he lied. Yes, he lied. It was terrible. The other guy, you know, the one with the questionable ethics, apparently lied 30 times, 30,000 times in his office when he was in office. But again, it just goes to show that it's the system is broken in the US. The US is no longer governed by serious people, if you ask me. And, you know, that's just going to get worse. And I think I don't buy this whole argument also around, like, it's not good for the norms and what have you. Basically campaigning on the whole notion of I'm going to go after my opponents is, last time I checked, not the norm. Nominating someone like Kash Patel to run the Premier Enforcement Investigation Agency is not the norm. You know, giving pardons to people who stormed the Capitol and referring to them as patriots and pardoning them is not the norm. I know I'm completely...
Given Kash Patel's skill around children's books, Suzanne, apparently book day is going to be great for all the staff when they bring their bring your kid to school day at the FBI.
Well, I did order that a book for my six-year-old.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, go and check out Kash Patel's book, which apparently he's actually done a really... Like, he's sold that incredibly well. People have bought that rubbish. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
I would like Hunter Biden to commit a crime that falls just outside the definitions or areas covered by the pardon. That's what looking forward to.
It's going back 11 years.
It's a crime abroad, and the pardon doesn't cover that. So those are my hopes for the next 12 months.
I was hoping that he could be sent as the ambassador to France. But let's there must be a way you can do that.
If Trump really wants to have his revenge, you should send him as the ambassador to Colombia or Bolivia.
You know, it's almost been a year to the day that Put Simply was launched, and I'm seriously considering whether we got the name of this podcast right. Given the year we've had, it should probably be You Can't Make This Stuff Up. Let's consider that going into 2025 and beyond. Gents, thank you so much for another week. It's been great chatting. See you next.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.